In this week's parasha, the Torah tells us that Vayahavi Yitzchak is Esav, ki tzayid b'fiv. He loved Esav, ki tzayid b'fiv. Many of you know the Medrash that Rashi quotes, that Esav was merame Yitzchak, he showed himself to be a tzaddik. He would ask, Abba, how are you ma'aser teven, how are you ma'aser melach, which of course you're not ma'aser because there's no din of ma'aseros by Tevin and Melach. They're not, Melach is not gidulei karka and Tevin is not food. But Esav wanted to show himself, make his father think he was a tzaddik, ki tzayid b'fiv. Pshuta shel mikra, however, is suggested by the Targum, ki tzayid b'fiv, and Targum says, arei mi tzedei hava achel. Yitzchak loved Esav because Esav used to provide him with tzayid. He used to feed him. Ibn Ezra, commenting on the fact that Esav was not interested in the Bechorah, which seems to be very strange. It seems strange to sell your double portion in the inheritance for a bowl of lentil soup. Very strange. Ibn Ezra says Esav didn't care because Yitzchak was impoverished. And therefore, if the estate is worth $10, the chelek of the Bechorah might be worth less than the bowl of lentil soup. Now, of course, Yitzchak, we know later, was wealthy, so Ibn Ezra deals with that question. But Ibn Ezra points to the fact that ki tzayid b'fiv. In other words, Esav was the one who provided food for the household. There was obviously some other things. They did have some goats, but you don't want to always have to shech those goats. So Esav basically stepped into the role of providing food for the household because his father was blind and unable to provide. In other words, Esav understood, for all of his chesronos, Esav HaRasha understood the need for him to make a contribution in the context of their household. The Torah, in Parshas Kisisa, talks about the mitzvah of maintaining the Beis HaMikdash, the way Chazal understood it. It was done for a census, but subsequently it was done Lidoros to provide for the needs of the Beis HaMikdash. And that institution was known as the Machtzis HaShekel. When it comes to the Machtzis HaShekel, there is really a dual requirement or a dual mitzvah. On the one hand, the Torah states, He'ashir lo yarbev hadal lo yamit. Every single Jew is obligated to give the Machtzis HaShekel, not more, not less. And that was the money that was used to maintain the Beis HaMikdash, to make the repairs, to buy the karbanos, to do everything that was needed in the Mikdash and even sometimes in Yerushalayim. That Machtzis HaShekel was everybody's obligation, and everybody's obligation equally. It didn't matter whether you were poor, it didn't matter whether you were rich, so you gave a Machtzis HaShekel. The mitzvah Machtzis HaShekel, however, is also the source for another very important din. The pasuk in Ezra tells us that one of the things Ezra, or Nehemiah, I don't remember which one, was misaking, was that everybody would give their Shlishis HaShekel Bashana. They would give a third of a shekel. As I'll explain, that the reason it's a third of a shekel, it was really the Machtzis HaShekel, but they had changed the weights and measures. Higdilu hamidos, and now what had been a Machtzis HaShekel, Moshe Rabbeinu's time, was now a Shlishis HaShekel. That's not interesting in its own right as much as for the fact that when it comes to the mitzvah of tzedakah, the Gemara in Baba Basra and the Shulchan Aruch quotes this in Yeridei and Hilchos Tzedakah, paskins that way, that every Jew, regardless of their status, is required to give a minimum shear of tzedakah in a year of a shlishis hashekel. But in the context of Hilchos Tzedakah, that is not the same obligation for everybody. It is an absolute minimum. A person who is wealthier is obviously obligated to give more. The Mida Beinonis for a person who can afford it is Meiser Ksofim, Meiser for income. And a midah, the proper midah for someone who can afford it really is to give 1/5, 20%, and not more. Hamavazdeis ayuvazdeis yosemei chomesh. So in effect, Machtzis HaShekel really has two different kinds of monetary obligations. On the one hand, it's a fixed amount for everybody, no less and no more, no matter how wealthy or no matter how poor you are. On the other hand, it also serves, and that's to build the Beis HaMikdash and to take care of the Beis HaMikdash's needs. And then in terms of tzedakah, there's a second obligation which varies based upon the ability of the individual to afford to give the tzedakah, ranging somewhere between shlishis hashekel and 20% of one's nechasim. When shuls today often make appeals, when they make, for example, a kol nidre appeal, you very commonly hear this idea that they want everybody to participate. It doesn't matter if you're giving a tiny amount, they want everybody to participate. The reason I suspect they do that, for the most part, is not necessarily for halachic reasons, but for psychological reasons. You want everybody to feel the obligation and to feel like they're a shutaf. You want them, by getting up and getting them to give even something to the appeal, it makes them be more part of the shul, even for their own psychology. If you want to call it cognitive dissonance, if I'm giving money to the shul, it must be because it's an important cause. Even if I'm only giving $10 to the Kol Nidre appeal, because it's my shul and I have to be involved. For psychological reasons, probably. But one might argue that from a halachic perspective, it's also in line with values. Not obligations, but values. That there's a certain minimum everybody gives. In this case, it's something. And of course, people who can afford to give more should give more. In other words, we want everybody to participate. That's like the machtes ha-shekel. It's a relatively minimal amount. And yet, obviously, those who can give more. When you talk about most shuls, we'll tell you that, you know, their membership dues do not cover only a fraction of the costs of running the shul, and they need all sorts of other ways of raising money. There is a book in Treyasar that most people are probably not terribly familiar with. Most of you, I'm sure, have heard of it. I'm also willing to bet most of you actually probably have not had the opportunity yet to learn it, and are unfamiliar with its contents. The book I'm referring to is one of the shortest books in Tanakh, not the shortest, but one of them, which is the book of Chagai. Chagai is a little sefer of two chapters. He's the third to last of the Treyasar. And the story of much of Chagai is the following. The Jews returned from Golos, and they rebuilt their lives, and they rebuilt their homes and planted their fields. But the Beis HaMikdash was left in a desolate state. They didn't bother to pay attention to God's house. And that made the Ribbono Shalom unhappy. The popular refrain, as Haggai attributes to the people, is Lo esbo, esbo Hashem, es Beis Hashem lihibanos. Time hasn't arrived yet to rebuild God's house. They were too busy building their McMansions, but they weren't actually building the Beis HaMikdash. And God was pretty upset about that. And basically, he tells them the reason why your produce yields are cursed is essentially because Yan Beisi Hu Charev Ve'atem Ratzim Ish Leveso. He said, my bias is destroyed, and you're each running to your houses. He also talks about how Eis La Sheves Bevateichem Sifunim, you sit enveloped and cocooned in your beautiful houses. Right? That's not the time. You have an obligation to build my house and to build my house first. And what's true about building the Beis HaMikdash is also true about maintaining the Beis HaMikdash. It's that a Kadosh Baruch Hu's house has to have the proper upkeep. The Gemara in Shabbos quotes a statement in the name of Rav, Rav Chama Bar Guria in the name of Rav, that any year shegagoseha gevoa mi Beis HaKnesses l'besof charva, a city whose roofs are higher than the roof of the Beis HaKnesses, in the end, will be destroyed. Quoting a pasuk from Ezra Nehemiah, L'romeim es beis Elokeinu, to raise up the house of God higher, and means higher than everybody else's houses. And here the Gemara applies it in the context, of course, of a Beis HaKnesses, which is a Mikdash Ma'at. The Shulchan Aruch quotes this din in Simin Kofnun. But what's very interesting is that when the din is quoted, the obligation of not having the roof higher is not primarily a physical din, but it's a spiritual din. And what I mean by that is that if you have a tower built on your house that nobody can go in, you have a spire built, that's okay. That can be higher than the roof of the Beis HaKnesses. Your living quarters, the Makom Shedarbo, that's not allowed to be higher than the Beis HaKnesses. The Shulchan Aruch says you're supposed to build the Beis HaKnesses in the highest point of the city. I think actually Rinat and Beth Aaron are the only two shuls that might be Mekayim. And I think altitudinally, they're about the highest, they're almost Shavah, about the highest places in Tinek. But in seriousness, it's supposed to be in the highest place. And where you live, you're always supposed to be looking up to the Beis HaKnesses. So it's not just a physical statement, I think, but it's a metaphorical statement. That even as you dwell in your house, the direction that you always look up to is in fact the Mikdash Ma'at, the Beis HaKnesses. The Beis HaKnesses is called the Mikdash Ma'at, not simply as a metaphor, but many of the dinim, not all of them, but many of the dinim in the Beis HaMikdash apply to a Beis HaKnesses. For example, the din of Kapandaria. You're not allowed to use the Beis HaMikdash as a shortcut. You happen to be on the south side, you want to get to the north side. You're not allowed to walk through for the purposes of using the shortcut. That is true for the sanctuary of Beis Knesset as well. If you happen to be in the lobby of my shul and you want to get to the parking lot and it's pouring, you're not allowed to walk through the shul to get to the exit that's right by your car, because that's making a shul a kapandarya. So it's called a Mikdash Ma'at because in many ways it is like a Beis HaMikdash. And the fact that a shul is like a Beis HaMikdash imposes a dual obligation upon a community. And I want to talk about both of those dual obligations. The first is the way the shul behaves, klape chutz. And the second is the way the individuals behave, klape pnim, towards the shul. The shul, as the spiritual center of a Torah community, must be the repository and reflect the Torah values of a community. Regardless of what people do in their private lives, many shuls in the past, and some even now, especially out of town, but not only, have many members who attend davening on Shabbos, but are not Shomrei Shabbos, and they drive to shul. What the shul typically does in those cases is they close the parking lot before shul. And many of the people who drive to shul, they don't park in front of the shul. They have the Derech Eretz to park a block away. Regardless of what some people do in their private lives, they're welcome in the shul. But the values of Torah are respected in the confines of the shul itself. And that means that the shul's behavior as an institution has to reflect those values. If a Kohen marries a Grusha, he may be welcome to daven in the shul. But we don't wish him a mazel tov on his marriage. It is also highly questionable to recognize him and his Grusha wife as family members of the shul, since their family, even though Kiddushin are tofsin, is ba'avera. The same holds true for an intermarriage. The Jewish member may be welcome, but we don't congratulate him or them on a marriage, which as far as the Torah and Halacha are concerned, doesn't exist. You certainly don't wish a mazel tov to the couple on the birth of a non-Jewish child, if it emerges from such a union. Certainly, if the man is Jewish and the child is born, there's no mazel tov on the birth of a non-Jewish child. The same holds true for the issue of gay marriage. A Torah values observant shul doesn't wish a mazel tov on a marriage that represents a violation of halacha and doesn't exist halachically. And in the case of two males, represents an aveir of Yehri Vial Yavor. And I want to comment here. People often say, just because they're getting married, you don't know what they do privately. It's very clear what marriage means, what it has meant classically, and what it means in halacha. What is different, the biggest change between before marriage and after marriage, and I would say specifically Nisuin, is the permission to cohabit, the permission to engage in sexual relations. People will say, but you don't know what other people are doing behind closed doors. Maybe they're not keeping Taras HaMishpacha. It's true. I don't know that all couples in my shul are observing Taras HaMishpacha. But if they aren't, their marriage is not advertising that publicly. Right? They could be observing Taras HaMishpacha. They might not be observing. I don't know. I would certainly object them walking into shul, carrying a sign, and say, we don't use the mikveh. So the marriage itself, you're right, you don't know what people do behind closed doors. But what a marriage between a zachar and a keva represents is a marriage that potentially is one that can be engaged with and conducted 100% beheter. I don't need to peer into people's privacy to know what they're doing. But acknowledging a gay marriage by its very definition is acknowledging something that is fundamentally aser. And I should note in this context, because there are some people who would distort it, Mishkav Zachar is not the only thing that's aser. Losikravu, ki rebasar is also aser. It's a machlokas harishonu, whether it's an Issa Daraisa or the Rabbanon. And for the Rambam who holds it's an Issa Daraisa, we would paskin that it's Yehri Vial Yavor also. a shul may and should be welcoming of all Jews. And God forbid should anybody belittle a non-observant Jew, and particularly in the case of someone who is gay. God forbid that someone should belittle them, should make light of them, should be unempathetic to them. It is an unusually difficult predicament for people in that situation, and it's not a case where we can really say it's Isser v'heter munachan lefanav, and he chooses the Isser over the heter. It's really not that case. But at the same time, God forbid that a mikdash ma'at should ever congratulate someone on such a marriage, or extend a family membership in such a case, because halachically speaking, it is not a family. The Mishnah in Gittin says that ein machzikin yedei over avera. The Magen Avraham in Siman Shin Mem Zayin points out that when someone is engaged in doing malacha, derech eretz is that you say, you know, chazak, you know, hatzleach b'malachtacha, tatzleach b'malachtacha. You should be successful. But if their malacha is a malachas iser, then it's aser to do so, based upon the Mishnah in Gittin. I'm not sure exactly what the nature of the prohibition is. It should be intuitive that it's aser. It might be perhaps an outgrowth of lifnei iver. It might be actually an active bittul of the mitzvah of tochacha, which even if you can't do tochacha, because we don't know how to do tochacha and people are not mekabel tochacha, but you certainly cannot do the inverse of tochacha, to wish someone yashikoach on an avera. So, whatever the reason is, it's aser. And therefore, bate kinesios should strive to be tolerant and accepting, but God forbid if it means violating a halacha or expressing support for such a violation. That's the first obligation, the way a shul is manik itself. The cholksos halacha, Shabbos, kashrus, taras hamishpacha, arayos, everything. A shul's values and its publicly expressed values have to be in accordance with Torah and halacha. Then there's a second angle, which is in the reverse. The obligation of individuals in a community to a base knesses. Every single member of the community is responsible for contributing to the building and upkeep of a community and its base knesses to the best of his or her ability. This is true both b'mamono and begufo. The notion of an individual who lives in a home or an apartment and doesn't contribute to the base knesses is Haggai's equivalent of Yan Beisihu Charev V'Atem Ratzim Ish Leveso. When you step into a Beis HaKnesses, and there's heating or air conditioning, and lights, and a Rav to whom you can ask shailas, and a hot kiddush that everybody's running to after shul, do you think that money falls from Shamayim to support these things? When your own home takes priority and means that you feel free not to contribute to the shul, that is to build, metaphorically, your roof higher than that of the Beis HaKnesses. The model of Machatzis HaShekel is appropriate here. The way most shuls run, there is a base membership, but that is nowhere near enough to cover everything the shul provides. And that is done, the rest of it is done through fundraising. Everybody is expected to contribute on some level, and financially, and beyond that, each can contribute and must contribute in their own way. Some may give extra money. Some may contribute by laning. Some by helping run events for the shul that build community or raise funds. Some may help clean up the shul. Others will bind the fraying books or maintain the library. Some will give extra shiurim. And sometimes, not in so many of our shuls locally, but sometimes, even making the minyan is part of doing your service to the community. But everybody must contribute. And in a way that Chazal would describe, lefi gam la'shechna, according to the camel, is its burden. Some people will say, I can't afford it. I would respond that you can't afford not to. Spending on a Beis HaKnesses is not a discretionary item. Do you have a Netflix subscription? Cable television? Cancel it. You're flying somewhere for vacation? On a ski trip? Don't go. Eating out in restaurants? Those are discretionary spending. That's discretionary spending. The Beis HaKnesses comes first. And for those who truly can't afford it, shuls make accommodations. And then you can make it your business to maximize your contribution in non-financial ways by giving of your time to the shul. The Gemara in Brachos tells us, Kol hanena min ha'olam hazeh b'li bracha ma'al. If you nenet from this world without a bracha, without giving thanks to the Ribbono Shalom, it's like violating Ilah. And the Gemara then says, it's like you took hana, illicit hana, from the kachim of the Ribbono Shalom. And then the Gemara continues, if you nenem in a olam azeh b'libracha, it's like you've stolen from God and the Jewish people. Shenemar gozel avivi imo v'omer in pasha chaverhu le'ishmashchis. Someone who davens in a shul, a mikdash ma'at, and takes advantage of what it provides without contributing, is as if he or she was nenem mekotshei shemayim and has violated me'ilah. And it doesn't matter if you daven in multiple shuls. I'm told that some people determine where they go to the shul depending upon who has the best kiddush that Shabbos. I don't know if that's true. But ge gesund tehet. You want to do, that's wonderful. But if you daven in multiple shuls on any regular basis, you need to contribute to any place where you go to. Many communities have a structure where you're a member primarily in one shul, and when you daven some of the time at the shul, you become an associate member. Smaller amount of money, you don't contribute a building fund. It's understood. People have a home base. But if you use a shul, you have to contribute. And if you don't, even though technically speaking you may not be, in the spirit of the law, you are a gazlan. Thus, a Beis HaKnesses is the focus and repository of communal Kedusha. The Beis HaKnesses must behave in a way to uphold those values. Be as welcoming and tolerant as you can to others who are not fully observant, in one way or another, but must always remember that while any individual is welcome, the averos are checked at the door. And on the flip side, every member of the community must find his or her or their mikdash ma'at and then contribute financially and otherwise, because that is what a properly mechunach Torah Jew does, and because to not do so is the equivalent of stealing kachei shamayim. Even Esav HaRasha understood this. While his brother Yaakov was a Yoshev Ohalim, he advanced the spiritual needs of the family. He was busy working, as Unklus and Ibn Ezra would have us, to provide food for them to eat. Rabosai, when you graduate this institution and you move out into a community, among your first responsibilities is to find the shul that you want to daven in. One might even go so far as to suggest that sometimes the basis on which you select a community is to find a kehillah that you want to join and daven with. And once you've done that, your next responsibility is to become part of that shul in an appropriate manner. Bein begufcha, bein bemamoncha. That contribution takes precedence over discretionary spending. Whether literally, monetarily, or metaphorically speaking, regarding your time. You can't say, I don't have time to help out in the shul, when I'm watching both football games on Sunday afternoon and then the nightcap. You're doing that, you have time. Most people, you want to make time, you will find time for the shul. And thus, even though Yaakov Avinu is our ultimate role model in all aspects of his behavior, even Esav HaRasha, who was Zera Avraham, of Esav HaRasha of Unklus and Ibn Ezra, can remind us about something important for every Ben and Bas Torah. Shabbos.